This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. It may surprise you, but Hawaii doesn't require paid family leave. There are some protections under the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act and local coverage through the Hawaii Temporary Disability Insurance Program, but otherwise, programs vary among employers. Lawmakers asked for a study on the possible costs of a state-paid family leave plan. The report compared the plans of seven states that currently provide the family leave. It looked at how those plans are funded and administered and benefits to workers, more specifically, how many days could be taken off and how much money they would get. Deborah Zeisman is the executive director of the Hawaii Children's Action Network, which advocates for children's issues in Hawaii. She spoke to producer Jason Ubai about the results of the study.
So in Hawaii right now, there are no workers with guaranteed paid family leave. So right now, it really depends on who your employer is. Some employers offer paid leave for family caregiving, whether it's maternity, paternity, or having an ill spouse or child or parent, and others do not. Hawaii does have an unpaid leave for larger companies as well. So that you can take leave and your job will be there, but there's no pay. And we know in Hawaii that's difficult for many families. We know many of our families are living paycheck to paycheck, don't have a lot of savings. So for a lot of folks, they really need to be at work, even when they also want or need to be doing family caregiving. There have been groups, including Hawaii Children's Action Network and the Working Families Coalition that's formed, working and talking about paid family leave for over a decade now. Now, families need it. We know families need to take time off from work in order to do caregiving. It happens time to time for really everyone. So we had a much more lively and public debate in 2018 during that legislative session where the Working Families Coalition and a whole lot of family advocates were really pushing for paid family leave to join the numerous other states now that have these policies and programs. At the end of the 2018 legislative session, the legislature determined that they wanted a bit more information on the models that were being used in other states, how they're paying for it, sort of more than nuts and bolts. So where we ended the 2018 legislature was not a question of if families need it. There was general consensus in the community that families need this. They need to be able to take a limited time off to do family caregiving and have some partial pay at least in order to keep paying the rent and putting food on the table and then come back to their work. So the legislature set aside some funding and commissioned a study to take a look more at the, what I would say, the nuts and bolts of things, like how, more the how are we going to get it done, how is it working in other states, and to take a look at what model will be best for Hawaii. So it's very exciting that the study is finally out because now we have, I think, the information we need to move ahead this coming year and implement a program for our state.
So you looked through the study. Any surprises for you?
I think it very much aligns with other reports from Hawaii and nationally and shows what we know. It shows that there is a great need. We know that most folks are in the workforce here. They need short-term leave when they have a child or a sick parent, and they don't have deep savings. It shows that nationally we now have eight other states and Washington, D.C. have these programs, and that most common, the way they are run, is with what's called a social insurance model. That means it's kind of like Social Security, that everyone pays in through like payroll deduction. We all pay in a little bit each paycheck, and then it's an insurance model. So when we need to take time off to take care of a parent, a spouse, a child, you would then apply and draw down from that insurance program. I think it also showed some of the potential costs. The estimated cost for the average worker, depending on how many weeks off and things like that, it fluctuates. So how long the leave is, the estimated cost for an average worker in Hawaii is between $46 and $104 a year. So you're talking, again, you know, a dollar or two a paycheck that goes into this insurance program. And then the estimates for the state to start up the this model is a little over $1 million to kind of start it up, put the infrastructure in place that wouldn't be needed.
It sounds like there is support, and well, this does lay out most of the options. I know besides the social insurance option, there was an employee mandate, which would be closer to Hawaii's TDI and also Prepaid Healthcare Act.
Correct. And so that's explored in here as well. I think they did not get into it that much because what they said is states that have options for employers to buy their own insurance also have to have quite a bit of government oversight to make sure there's compliance, for example. Also, running the program as a social insurance, like the government operates it, is actually cheaper and ensures that there's not fraud, things of that sort. So, but they did explore that model as well, because we do see in a few states kind of a hybrid model that companies can opt out and buy into their own plan as well.
What would be like some challenges or roadblocks ahead?
Well, I think we'll be talking to our lawmakers, and what we really need, I think, is for the community to share with their elected officials why there's this need. We know we value family. It's one of our deepest values here in the state. And really for anyone, because this applies even if you don't have children, right? It applies to any kind of family caregiving where you need a short-term leave from work. What we have been asking for at Hawaii Children's Action Network and the broader Working Families Coalition is 16 weeks, and that it would have partial pay. So you would not get your full paycheck for that time when you're off taking care of your spouse or your parent or your child, but you'd get partial pay. I think the challenge, like anything, is getting new programs started up in our state. So it's really important for the community, if you have a need for this program, to get involved, to let your lawmaker know how this would help your family, to share your story of how it's been a struggle. We've definitely heard anecdotally from folks that they had to tap all their savings, max out their credit cards, you know, take money out of a 401k if they had one, that it really has doing family caregiving, whether for a new baby or another family member, often is what puts families in an economic hardship, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. We know our families are in a fragile place, and how do we speak up, get involved, and say how this would really benefit your family?
Since the study kind of pointed out more towards a social insurance model, do you see as much pushback as in previous efforts from businesses and employers?
Well, we shall see. I think, again, we have numerous states now with this type of program in place. We still see businesses operating. And I think the study does show that from many perspectives, having the social insurance model where the government is having the management of it is the most economical and, frankly, the easiest for the companies. The company doesn't have to worry about buying an insurance plan on the side. It's like unemployment. It's being run by our state.
Anything else in particular with this study or paid family leave?
I think that is it. Our legislature starts in January, so I think we need to start talking to our lawmakers now about how to make sure that our families have this type of program.
That was Deborah Zeisman from Hawaii Children's Action Network talking with Jason Ubai about paid family leave. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz. We are more than halfway through the month, and perhaps you've noticed a bit more facial hair on coworkers who are usually clean-shaven. It could be that they didn't want to pick up a razor, or they could be participating in Movember, a movement that started in 2003 where participants commit to growing mustaches for the whole month in order to raise money and awareness about men's health issues. Well, before Movember, Hollywood had its fair share of famous mustaches. Think Clark Gable, Burt Reynolds, and Ron Burgundy. For today's quiz, we're interested in a mustache that you may remember seeing in movies, such as A Star is Born, The Big Lebowski, and did you hear about the Morgans? The actor we're thinking of has been credited in more than 80 film and television projects, including an appearance on the classic Hawaii Five-0. Here's one final clue. He was inducted into the Mustache Hall of Fame the same year as Tom Selleck. So for today's quiz, can you name this thespian? Think you know? Well, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Up next, HPR's Bill Dorman and Ryan Finnerty talk Chinese tourism.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the real estate agents and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing local stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
Tourism remains a critical economic driver in Hawaii, and while the largest markets are domestic visitors and the Japanese, there's been a bit of an obsession for many years about the potential of China. They still represent a very small percentage of visitors to Hawaii, and the numbers have actually dropped in recent years, well before the current trade dispute. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has done a little digging into those numbers and the story behind them, and he joins us with more. And Ryan, I was surprised to learn that Chinese tourism to Hawaii actually peaked back in 2015.
Yeah, that's right, Bill, at 173,000 annual visitors. So when you compare that to 10 million almost annual visitors to Hawaii now, what we're shooting for in 2019, pretty small percentage. Last year in 2018, it worked out to only be about 1.2% of total visitors to Hawaii were Chinese. And as you mentioned, that number has been falling. Peaking in 2015, last year it was down to just over 120,000, so a pretty substantial decline from that peak in 2015. But as you mentioned, there's reason for people in the tourism industry to be interested in attracting Chinese visitors, because around the world, not just here in Hawaii, but in the United States more broadly and around the world, Chinese visitors spend more per day when they travel than almost any other group. Here in Hawaii, that works out to be about $350 per person per day, and that's well above any other group. The Japanese are usually the next highest, and they're substantially below the Chinese. And China has 1.4 billion people living in its country, the most populous on Earth. And so that's an enormous market for any industry, including tourism. And so people here are thinking that maybe they will be a major player in the Hawaii market someday. And I spoke with a man named Anu Anwar. He studies China at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies and the East-West Center, which are both here in Honolulu. And he studies China pretty extensively and a lot of factors of their economy. And he gave me one explanation for why Chinese travelers have become such a major economic force around the world in recent years.
850 million Chinese people leaped out of poverty. In the 1980s, 88% of Chinese people was living under poverty. And this percentage is down to less than 1% today. So people first leapt out of poverty, and then they enter into the middle class. So in 2002, only 4% of Chinese was in the middle class. And this number is today now 35%, and constituting almost 500 million Chinese now living in the middle class.
Some pretty remarkable numbers there. Worth repeating, 850 million Chinese citizens removed from poverty in the last 40 years, from almost 90% of the population to less than 1% today, and their Chinese middle class is larger than the entire population of the United States, 500 million people.
And that change, again, of 2002, only 4% of Chinese were in the middle class, and now it's up to 35%.
Huge.
That's
remarkable. And as we know, as in any other country, as in here in the United States, the middle class, people like to travel. They have a little bit more disposable income. And that's what Anu told me is the reason that they have now, they being Chinese travelers, have become such a major force in the global tourism industry.
If you take year 1997, only 5.3 million Chinese tourists took overseas trip. And now today, 140 million Chinese tourists per year took overseas trip, whose number is equal to total population of Russia.
Another pretty remarkable statistic. And so those 140 million, it's upwards of 150 million, it's looking like this year, 2019, they're worth, the latest estimate, $250 billion globally. They contribute to economies around the world. And what Anu said is that the leaders of the Chinese government in Beijing will sometimes use all that economic power as a tool to influence the actions of governments around the world. And he gives several examples of this. The earliest one was in the year 2000 when China restricted tourist flows to Turkey. It was trying to buy an old Soviet ship and turn it into an aircraft carrier for the Chinese Navy, and it had to transit from the Black Sea through the Strait of Bosphorus, which Turkey controls, and Turkey, as a NATO ally, kind of was pressured to not allow that, and China hit back with these sanctions on the tourism industry, and Turkey eventually relented and allowed the ship through. That's happened a lot in Asia as well. In last year, 2018, hundreds of flights from mainland China to Taiwan were canceled after some political disputes between those two governments. The year before that, 2017, annual Chinese visitors to South Korea dropped by 4 million in just 1 year after the South Korean government allowed the deployment of an American missile defense system to that country that China opposed. It's happened with Japan as well. And Anu says that we could be seeing this here in the United States, that there's been declines in Hawaii for several years. It's now starting, Chinese visitors to the United States are starting to decline more broadly starting last year. Fewer are coming to the United States. And Anu says this could be because the Chinese government is trying to steer its citizens away from visiting the United States because of this trade war. But he also said they've taken a more subtle approach than with some of these other examples. Rather than outright sanctions or restrictions, they've chosen instead to use some more subtle approaches, using state media to kind of portray America as a dangerous or unfriendly place to Chinese citizens, trying to get people to take their business elsewhere, basically.
Joseph Nye, a long time ago at Harvard, wrote famously about soft power, and this tourism as soft power doesn't often come up in that discussion, but certainly in terms of the Chinese dealing with it, that's one illustration of that. But also can have an impact on, the illustrations that you gave regionally, but it's also the change in the behavior of consumers, as you've mentioned with Chinese tourists, as with many, as these develop and the middle class grows. The tendency is to travel first in groups. You saw this with the Japanese as well. And then tourists want to go on their own. And that's something that you're seeing with Chinese travelers as well.
Yeah, they're tending to move away, especially younger travelers, move away from the big tour groups, going individually. And that also means that they go to new destinations each time. So it's not going to be the same steady flow of repeat customers. And they're kind of in that same line of thought. There is a competing explanation for why the numbers of Chinese visitors are declining, and it's more of a free market one. I talked with Reen Ho Fung, who is the strategic advisor on China for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. She's based in Shanghai, and she says that 15 years ago, there were only 20 to 30 destinations approved by the Chinese government for its citizens to travel to. And the situation is much different today.
You know, today, we now have 150 destinations. You know, we are competing not just with countries, but there are also cities and states.
And she said there's also some more kind of logistical issues, like the cost of a visa. Chinese citizens have to pay to get a visa to the United States, even for a tourist visa. It's almost $200. They have to appear at a U.S. consulate or embassy to apply for one, whereas a lot of other countries will give Chinese citizens a free visa on arrival when they land in that country. So just small things like that that can make a big difference. Reen said the cost of a visa can be as much as 5% of the total cost of a trip for a Chinese visitor coming to the United States. So things like that serve as a deterrent, making other destinations relatively more attractive.
Interesting, and that visa waiver point for Hawaii in particular with South Korea, that made a huge difference when South Korea was put on the list for visa waivers in terms of then following growth of tourism from South Korea. But China, interesting on the visas and the interviews and the costs as well. A little more complicated of a story than at first blush.
Yeah, perhaps not as clear-cut as what the talking points coming out of Washington might have you believe.
Ryan Farrandy, thanks for covering that, Ryan.
My pleasure, Bill.
Ryan Farrandy covers news and politics here at Hawaii Public Radio.
Honolulu Civil Beat gives us a regular reality check. Today, the subject is Hawaii's number one crop, corn. Business reporter Stuart Yurton joins us this morning. Hi there.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
So you did a deep dive on my favorite subject.
Yeah, so we took a look at the corn industry, and as we know here, you know, the corn that we grow here isn't really for food. We grow a lot of corn for seed, which we then send elsewhere that people plant, farmers plant, to grow more corn.
And it's amazing because people don't realize how much money was coming into our economy when corn replaced sugar.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the right now we're looking at the value of this crop at about a little bit more than 100 million a year. But, you know, there was a time when we were talking about $250 million a year, the USDA was reporting the value of this industry. So it's still big. It's still the biggest. It used to be a lot bigger.
So we've seen a lot of these mega companies come in and take over these fields, you know, planting corn seed. There's been a lot of pushback, though, because of all these environmental issues.
Oh, there has, for sure. You know, there's been efforts to ban GMO corn being grown on some of the neighbor islands. There's been pushback trying to regulate the use of the pesticides, which we can talk about in a little bit more detail, the pesticide use. Regulating this on the local level is hard. Those regulations were challenged in court. It went to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and the federal court system. And those local county island regulations were struck down. So, yeah, there is a lot of pushback, though, continuing.
So you went on a recent briefing. Is it with Bayer, Monsanto?
Yes, exactly. Right. So as you recall, the big mega companies, they're all kind of changing. Monsanto, what used to be Monsanto, was acquired by Bayer. So Bayer, the big German chemical company, acquired Monsanto. So we went out there. We talked to them. We sat down. Representatives from the other companies were there. And they really gave us an overview. And the upshot is that, you know, even with the declines, the industry is really here to stay. And as long as people are buying corn, they think that there's a need to grow the corn, the seed corn here in Hawaii.
So what did they say about the pesticide use?
You know, they didn't really talk about the pesticide use. It's obviously an issue. Just on yesterday, there was a settlement with the Department of Justice involving pesticides used on a farm, improperly. But you know, they really want to focus on the genetically modified corn that's developed for other traits, not necessarily pesticide resistant, which we all know about and have report on a lot. But, you know, the idea is that the crops, the corn can be tailored for all different kinds of climates, geographies, you know, places that have different growing season lengths, you know, and so forth. So if something developed for, say, you know, South Dakota would be a lot different from corn developed for Tennessee or Texas or something, with different climates.
And how do they explain the drop in what they're producing and what they're bringing in?
Yeah, that's a really good question that I spent some time talking to him about. So the idea is that if you look at the commodity price of corn, it's dropped too. So it makes it seem like this has something to do with that. They're saying it's not. They're saying that this isn't commodity corn. It's corn grown for seeds sold to farmers. The idea, though, is that as we've seen this consolidation of the industry and they've just gotten more experience here, they've gotten more efficient, which means they're actually spending less money here. And that when you look at the USDA report, there is a footnote in the report that says this, that really they're looking at the budget of the amount of money they're spending here to develop the corn, not necessarily what they call the farm gate value of the corn being sold. It's not exactly sold here. It's more transferred internally within the companies to another division. So it's not exactly being sold. And this drop really is a drop in investment and spending here. So for us, the outcome is pretty much the same as far as Hawaii is concerned. There's less money being spent by this industry here, a lot less.
Like, okay, but the bottom line is they're not going anywhere.
They're not going anywhere, although they're spending less.
All right. Yeah. Okay, thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Up next, Bill Dorman talks with our contributing political analyst, Neil Milner.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programs. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Health, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Highway Inn Hawaiian Food, now offering Hawaiian language lessons at its Kaka'ako location every other Sunday, 5 to 6:30 p.m. More information at myhighwayin.com.
If you've been listening to the impeachment hearings recently, you may feel like you've had your fill of politics. But there is new research out that makes some interesting points about voting behavior, and it has implications right here in Hawaii. Political analyst Neil Milner joins us with more on that in today's edition of The Long View. And Neil, this work really explodes a pretty well-worn myth about supporters of President Trump, that they tend to be working class and financially challenged, and it turns out that's not the case at all.
Right. It's actually new research and new research about old research, because not all that long after the 2016 presidential election, three political scientists did a study of who voted for Trump and who didn't, those kinds of Trump voters things, and said, hey, you know what? This idea that it was the working class that was the basis of the Trump victory is simply not true, that 75% of Trump voters were not we're basically white, and we're not of working class background. So that, in effect, from the get-go, there was much less of a working class base here, and there was evidence during the primaries that the Trump supporters were actually relatively well off, and we'll get to what that means in a second. So at that bit of research back in 2017, they said it's time that we got rid of this myth and took a better look and quit seeing it as this working class. These three people came back and did a more systematic study recently of Trump voters. And they did it in a very interesting sort of way. They said what we should look at is relative wealth and relative income compared to your neighborhood.
And where you
where
live.
You live.
As so opposed to some national
scale. That's right.
Scale.
Because the national scales will have a median income mm-hmm. thing, but a $50,000 in a low cost of living area with relatively low housing prices, if there is such a thing anymore, mm-hmm. is quite different than living on $50,000, say, here or anywhere else. So they did this statistical stuff with a very big sample, and they found out that that people who made above the median income in their area, so we're not talking about the 1% here. People who made above the median income in their area were more likely to vote for Trump than people that you would identify with the working class, making below median income, and the kinds of things that we assume are the working class. So if you just stop there and visualize what lots of people's perceptions are about the Trump voter, it's significantly different. And I think this attempt to do it in a relative sort of way makes a lot of sense because the country's made up of lots of different situations. To me, what it suggests is that the Trump voter, to put it in its simple terms, is much more like what we knew about the Tea Party activists in terms of their being relatively well off than they are like the persons that you read about in Appalachia and so on.
And disaffected.
Disaffected.
Angry,
yeah. Now, we're not getting away from disaffection or anger or racism or propensity toward authoritarianism, all of which show up in other studies. But what they say is, they're not tossing those aside, but what they're saying is you can't necessarily assume that those are working class issues that translated so heavily into Trump's victory. You have to look at other kinds of groups. And, you know, when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, and you start asking different sorts of questions. We knew from the get-go that the kind of working-class areas in certain states that were supposedly Democratic states, that there were a group of voters in those states that voted Republican that we would, we being the public, would think they wouldn't normally vote Republican. You always have to keep in mind, and that's where the media focused all attention on these
Wisconsin.
Disaffected in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And you picture these guys, you know, with empty lunch pails and all of this sort of stuff. But if you think about the election as a whole, first of all, a heavy, heavy percentage of people who identified as Republicans voted for Trump, the overwhelming majority. So that was that certainly was another factor. Turnout among African Americans, and Wisconsin was a key example of this, dropped significantly from what it was in 2016 to what it had been in the Obama thing. So you have all these other factors, but somehow, partially because of the salience of these states, we kind of generalized from it and focused so much on what was the working class in our minds.
And it really sort of underlines the danger of creating mythology in an easily sort of almost visual way.
Oh, yeah.
The media tends to do.
Oh, I think the media, I think this is a narrative that was so compelling that the media took it on. Listen, the media at best gets, to me, a D-plus in terms of the way it covered the 2016 election. And it wasn't just that Well, we can do a whole show on that sometime. But this is a compelling story, and it was an important story. I'm not saying that the switchers and that group are unimportant. I'm not saying there isn't a lot of disaffection and all of that, but you can't jump from that. And this frankly drives me nuts when I sit around and talk to my liberal friends who I identify with in terms of my politics, and they keep circling back to these kind of rednecks who don't know what they're doing, and they can't imagine why people would think like this. So I tell them two things. One thing I tell them is that your imagination is just limited, you know. And the second thing I tell them is that, you know, there is research on this, on a related issue, that suggests that liberals have much more harder time even comprehending opposing arguments than conservatives do with opposing arguments. And so some of it is this kind of otherness, this idea that we tend to want to identify people who think differently from us as being different from us in other ways. And, you know, you can think about some worker up in northern Wisconsin who really was pretty much disaffected about politics in general. And that's fine. But you can also think about your older, whiter neighbor, someone you might work out with at gym or that you work with, who's more like that. And again, it's not about rich people. Mm-hmm. This is not about rich people. This is just about people who are making a little bit more money than the folks in their neighborhoods.
That contextual wealth or the
Contextual wealth. Yes. That's right. Yes. Relatively rich versus relatively poor. Yeah, contextual wealth.
So if you turn this a little bit looking forward rather than looking backward, when you look through this prism at 2020, what comes to your mind?
Well, I think the first thing you have to remember, and this is a mantra, the first thing you have to remember is this suggests what we know and what will continue, and that is the power of party identification. Mm. That is, you can make a pretty good bet right now that the overwhelming majority of Republicans are going to vote for Trump, and the overwhelming majority of Democrats are going to vote for anybody who's on the Democratic ticket. So you're talking about a smaller group of people. So big picture is you want to understand that this is not all about this disaffected working class, because it turns out not to be true, and also because that doesn't explain the entire election. And when you look at the approval ratings for Trump by party, and when you look at the feelings about impeachment by party, you see it's an overwhelming, if 84% of the Republicans support Trump in approval rating or oppose impeachment, you have a pretty good sense of what 2020 is going to look like. I think another thing is that you see what the dilemma is for both political parties. That is, try to figure out how to deal with this disaffection. So we always assume that Trump is, which I think he is a demagogue. But it's not necessary that his demagoguery is appealing to kind of ignorant poor people. That doesn't seem to be supportive of it. So I think the Democrats are going to have trouble finding their footing because they don't know quite exactly how to manage this. But I think ultimately you always have to think about the stability factors in these kinds of campaigns. For sure, the Democrats are going to spend more time in the states that they blew last time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that the National Democratic Convention is in Milwaukee, it's not because there's so many Milwaukee Brewer fans. and I must say, as an ex-Milwaukeean, it's a great city in the summer, but that ain't why it's there.
Right.
So, but I think that these kinds of misunderstandings reflect a lot about how we think about ourselves.
Beware political mythology.
Yes.
Thanks, Neil. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Neil Milner, retired professor of political science, who joins us with his regular column, The Long View.
Around this time of year, there are men around the globe who put down the razor and brave Movember. What is Movember, you ask? Well, it's an annual campaign that started more than 15 years ago in Australia, where men grow mustaches in order to raise money and awareness about men's health issues. But mustaches were trendy before this. Remember Baseball Hall of Famer Raleigh Fingers? He brought back the handlebar mustache while pitching for Oakland. Even Hollywood has had its fair share of famous stashes. Think Clark Gable and Burt Reynolds. We asked you to name another popular mustache actor who appeared in more than 80 film and television projects, including an episode of Hawaii Five-O in the 1970s. His fans probably know him more for his work in westerns, like Gone to Texas or Tombstone. Sam Elliott's mustache stars in 26 movies, while his famous facial hair was not cast in 9 Sam Elliott movies. Congratulations to our winner, Zochi Mora from Maui. You got it right. If you have an idea for our quiz, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors The Rice Partnership, Kaiser Permanente, and PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Hawaii Public Radio is currently accepting nominations for its Community Advisory Board. We're seeking 10 volunteers who want to become more involved with their public radio station. These residents from across the Hawaiian Islands will have the opportunity to advise station management on HPR's programming and statewide outreach efforts. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org for the nomination form and more details.
With over 8 million YouTube views to his name, singer-songwriter Paul Isaac resonates with audiences around the world. The Waimanalo-based musician brings a message of hope, positivity, and respect for the Aina. Catch him Saturday, December 7th in HPR's Atherton Studio. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
We are just coming off National Children's Grief Awareness Day. The headlines in the news this month gives us pause to think about how our young people process grief. A mother of four killed on a crash on the Big Island, and here on Oahu, a 16-year-old intruder is shot by a Kalihi homeowner. Brooke Brown started a support group on Maui after her daughter, Emilia, died after a long illness, leaving behind a 3-year-old son. Brown talks about the origins of Children's Grief Awareness Day.
It started about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, back east. A group of kids wanted to start something because they felt so alone dealing with their grief, and they found that talking to each other really helped. And so they began this to just try to call attention to it. And one of the organizations that deserves a lot of credit that sprang into being along the way, New York Life Insurance, has made it their children's bereavement their signature philanthropy, and they've done a lot to promote the awareness of children's grief. And the Dougie Center, I believe, was the first group in the country, and they're about 35 years old. They're in Portland, Oregon, and they've been around, and I suspect we're working with those kids initially, and we've used them as a model for our group, as has Kids Hurt Too on Oahu, Kids Hurt Too Hawaii. And the Dougie Center really is the gold standard in the field.
So what is it we need to know about how children process grief?
I think that it's really important to realize that children's brains develop over time, so that grief for a 3-year-old is very different from grief for a 13-year-old or a 17-year-old. Their brains are developing all along the way, and so they can only understand death at certain levels. A 3-year-old, a 4-year-old does not have the death as permanent in their brain. So they're not going to understand that. And when they get a little older and they have the concept of permanence, it comes up again for them with different questions. And many times kids might seem fine, and then suddenly something triggers it. You know, maybe it's the first father-daughter dance or the mother-son dance, or the child dad was always going to be the one to teach them to drive a car, and suddenly they can get their permit. And all of a sudden, the grief just comes up, and they don't know what's happening necessarily, but they can start acting out, being depressed, having a lot of symptoms. And in fact, it's the grief that's surfacing. And so what's really important is for people to recognize how important it is to deal with it. And by deal with it, I mean talk about it. Talk about how kids are feeling. Not use euphemisms. We really stress that. When you tell a young child, oh, you know, mom went to sleep and died, I mean, that's a recipe for sleep disorders. And you don't want to say they passed or they went away, because the little kids are very literal. It doesn't compute with death to them. So it's like, use the word death. It takes the power out of it. Use the word die. Because one of the things that teens will tell you, adults will tell you when they had a death when they were young, they feel so alone in their grief. Most of their friends don't know what to say to them because it's an uncomfortable thing. Adults don't want to talk about it. Many times the kids will say, I can't talk to my mom about my dad because they were divorced and my mom hated my dad. Or I hear my mom crying every night, so I don't want to make her sadder. So the kids will put on a happy face, whereas in fact, they really need to talk about what they're going through. And with this happy face, sometimes parents don't want to bring up the person who died because they're afraid they're going to upset the balance. And it's not about forcing them. It's just to open the door so that they know, yeah, they can talk about the death or a problem they're having.
And oftentimes when there's a death, let's say, that involves a young person, many times the school will say, hey, we can provide counseling.
There's a huge need in the schools, and most school counselors have not been trained in children's grief, nor have the teachers. And a study was done several years ago, and something like 70% of teachers have a grieving student in their classroom at any time, and only 51% of school counselors have had in training in it. That's not going to go a long way. And I can give you firsthand examples of teens. I'm thinking of one young man who was an AP student. He was lined up to go to school in the East, great grades, the whole thing. And he experienced two deaths, parental deaths, within a very short period of time, relatively speaking, a couple of years. And after the last one, his grades tanked. When you're depressed, it's very difficult to focus. And his surviving parent would go to the school and beg for extensions for this child and special accommodations. And the teachers didn't cut him any slack. So his grades dropped. The trajectory changed at this point in time. And sadly, it's not uncommon. And we've had a very difficult time getting on board in schools because I think one of the attitudes is, you know, kids are resilient. And it's true, kids are resilient, but they're not resilient in a vacuum. They need the support around them. So where we've had great success is when we have both the administrators and at least one counselor who's on board, who really gets the importance, because we need a point person in the school because they coordinate what room we can use, what period we can go, and the kids come voluntarily. They really value the group. One of my facilitators said that she ran into one of these teens during the summer, and all the teen could talk about was, are you going to come back? When are you going to start? How soon can we start with group? Because they formed this little community. And I'm thinking last year we were at Kamehameha. We were both the elementary, middle school, and high school. And, you know, the classes there are relatively small. And we were getting feedback at the last group of one of the high school groups, and one of the young fellows said, this has been wonderful because I know everybody here, but I didn't know his uncle died, or I didn't know his father died, you know, because they don't talk about it, you know, among themselves. So suddenly having this community, small community on campus, they know who they can talk about their person with, and that's what we're trying to promote. Just give them places where they can talk about it. And, you know, it's their peers that they listen to. It's not us. We're the adults. You know, and we don't have the answers. They're the experts on the experience they're having. I started this several months after the death of my daughter, Amalia. And she died when her son, my grandchild, was a few days older, just had his third birthday. And she died of colorectal cancer and had fought this for a year and a half. And near the end, we saw the end, you know, with a very strong possibility, unless a miracle came along. And her son, as I say, was just under three, but there was a wonderful fable that we started reading to him about mudflies and mudbugs and dragonflies or something like this. It's really wonderful. And so we just tried to start preparing him for this. When you have a death coming, you know, somebody with a terminal diagnosis, you can involve the children, the young ones, in this. They get used to seeing the person in bed, and they can talk about it, and the family can talk about it, if the family will. Again, that's always a variable. But on some level, the child is anticipating that it's getting worse. So there's an absoluteness that happens with the death, which is hard no matter what. But it's not a shock. Whereas with a sudden death, particularly one that's violent, like a suicide or a car accident or a shooting or a stabbing, this is horrific. It's a shock, and they're also very traumatic, violent images that the child imagines. And that just adds to the complexity. Yeah. Right now on Maui, the estimate is Maui County, there are 2,200 kids under 18 who've had a parent or sibling die. It's huge.
That was Brooke Brown of Na Keiki o Amelia. For links to the group and Kids Hurt to Hawaii, to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for this week. Coming up on Monday, we take a closer look at the concept of decolonizing museums. Our program is a co-production, thanks to Lillian Tsang, Harrison Patino, and Jason Ubai. Mahalo to John DeMello for our backyard quiz theme. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.